in the award-winning Fat Wallet Show this week, investing for your parents. Hey, I'm Christia. With me, as always, Simon Brown. How are you?
I'm very good.
If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that we bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. So this is super fun now that we have a listener love index and a Zach One Lap index, because unsurprisingly, we are getting just our handed to us.
I thought we were going to delete the love index.
No, we're going to
get divorced?
We're going to reweight the love index.
I'm keen for a divorce.
We're going to divorce Steinhoff, that's for sure. We still need, actually, you guys should make some recommendations on how you think we should, what the criteria should be for kicking out a share out of the listener love index.
Like being down 90%.
Like down 90%, I feel, should be one
a
of the criteria.
Qualification.
But, you know, what about something that's down 43.5%?
No,
do we get that out? Anyway, so let us know how you guys think we
should proceed.
So
anything that is worse than the index. So the index is minus 10. Excuse me. Anything worse than minus 10 goes out. That's my vote.
Worse than the love index?
Yeah.
Oh, that's clever. But then, like, what, once a year?
Sure, once a year is good.
Or once a quarter?
No, quarter's quite short. That's fairly aggressive. I'm happy with annual.
It's also a lot of work.
Yeah, also a lot of work. So it's like half our index leaves.
Yeah.
So that, but the trick, what you're then essentially doing is you're switching this into a quasi-momentum index.
Yeah.
Which I don't mind, because I like momentum.
Well, but like a momentum index is not a love index, because then we would have to replace...
Yeah, but this love index is not a love index either. Love costs money. There is no love happening here.
We would have to replace the stuff that we take out, which means that we would then have
to get
basically
eight other
shares.
Yeah, we would need new love.
Anyway, that's down 10.5%, true to form. Zach's index is up 7.37% since we launched it.
Like 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks ago, because we were recording on a Tuesday.
Now I kind of wish that I had eyes on Zach's investment portfolio.
But also, here's the thing. So our love index was down minus 12 or something. So we actually, love's up 2%. Zach's up 7.
Zach's up 7.
He is the man of love.
Oh, Zach, you beautiful mind. All right, I have an update on my house buying debacle. So I applied for the owner finally signed, because this was the last thing we discussed. It took a long time for the owner to sign the offer to purchase. He finally agreed to the price, signed the offer to purchase. I did my applications through a bond originator, and without fail, every single bank came back and said, I contribute too much to my RA. For some reason, that discretionary investment offended the out of them. And I have no short-term debt, and it was a real mission for me to get a bank to actually approve. So all of them approved me, but the one bank offered me 200,000 rand less than I asked for, and at a ridiculous interest rate. The other bank offered me 100,000 rand less than I asked for at a ridiculous interest rate. So it's just been... So basically what they've said, what the financial system is telling me is don't save so much and have debt.
Yeah, because what
which
they...
Which is broken.
It's totally f- up. What they're looking at this, they're taking the view on this, that it is that your retirement annuity is not discretionary. You could at any point reduce or stop the retirement annuity, and that would change your disposable income in a blink.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, literally from month to month, I could have thousands more in my bank account.
Mm.
It's just so silly to me. And then I did an application through a bond originator, and they only work with the big banks. And then I also did an application through SA Home Loans that everybody's been telling me about. And then SA Home Loans actually phoned me, and the woman's like, look, it's been rejected because you have no credit record. And I said, but that can't be right, because I've got internet to my house. I've got insurance. Of course I've got a credit record. Like, I'm on the books somewhere, right? And she's like, no, they only see my insurance. They don't see my internet, which surprised me, because I thought that if you had some sort of contract.
Yeah, it depends who your provider is. So the provider has to submit to the credit unions and may not.
Yeah, and she's like, you have no credit record. So I say to her, so are you telling me if I go out, get a credit card, spend a lot of money for 3 months, you'll give me a home loan? And she's like, yes. And I was like, how does this make sense? It feels like I'm being punished for being good with money.
Yes, you are.
That's
yes, it is.
Anyway, that's where I am with the house. But like, things are moving at a glacial pace as well. I can't understand how anything can take this long.
Oh, the whole process. And I mean, you haven't even hit the lawyer stage yet, which is even worse. I mean, this whole, yeah. Expect it to be glacial. And then you go in and you sign documents and you get excited because something's happening. And then you hear nothing from no one for, months. So we signed for our place on, offer was accepted 15 December. I paid deposit and everything immediately. And it transferred into our name on 3rd of April.
Yes, that's insane.
So there was the December holidays, which skewed things a bit, but still.
I'm so glad that I asked for occupation. Like, that was a really good tip that you gave me, that you have to ask for occupation on a certain day. Because I thought that it was like, all right, cool, now it's signed, you get the bond approved, 3 weeks, it's done. No. It's a painful process. Uh-huh. This is why you should never do it.
No. I mean, go back to the beginning. You should not be buying a house. No, I mean, this is the truthful fact, but hey.
Oh, I did find a little loophole. Do you remember how I didn't get the inspection tip until after I'd signed the thing? So I'm going to ask the inspection company to come and look at some of the conditions of the sale and then do a proper inspection then as well. And then hopefully, because this whole process takes so long, like if there's something majorly wrong, hopefully I can find a way to have the owner.
Because also, so property is sold foot-to-toots, which means as is. But as is in law is not quite as is. For example, if the owner knows that there's a damp problem and just paint it over it, well, no.
Yeah, they are actually legally required to disclose that.
Yeah.
In the show notes from last week's episode, I included a link to the estate agent code of conduct, which has turned out to be incredibly useful because it kind of alerts you to all of the shit that estate agents tend to pull. So they actually had to codify it and say, look, if there's something wrong with the unit, you have to disclose it. And they also talk about like kind of how the estate agent is expected to behave towards the buyer and the seller. So if you're selling a house, we got a question about that we're not going to get to today. But if you're selling a house, go read those rules so that you know what your estate agent can and can't do for you. Anyway, weird process.
Horrible process. This is Monday, so Thursday we're at the JSC.
Oh, right. Yes,
time
we
travel.
Are. Yeah, so this coming Thursday, it's going to be me, you, Njabulo, and Devet, who's our tax elf, one of our tax elves. We have many of those because tax is super complicated. But we're going to do a live recording at the JSE in Johannesburg, and you guys should completely come.
Thursday.
It's free.
Thursday, 6 September, 5:30. You can pitch or you can book justonelap.com/events.
Yeah, probably book. Just to be safe.
Yeah, but then you're going to get spammed by the JSC. We don't mind. The JSC minds, but we don't.
All right. Today, I thought about investing for your parents for a few reasons. The other day, a friend of ours was here from Australia, and we were a group of people gathered around the table, like all of us in our 30s, like at various stages of our 30s, and we started talking about our parents, and it turns out that nobody's parents has money. Nobody's. Like, of the people around the table, there was one person who was like, you know what, actually, my mom's fine. Everybody else is like, okay, well, this is an issue. And then we happened to get this week two questions, one from Ruben and one from Twitter Daniel, about investing for their parents. And I thought, I initially wanted to call this episode, like, how to invest when it's too late to invest. But, like, I want to talk about what can be done if you've got some money that you would like to put towards the well-being of your parents in terms of just how to invest it, right? As opposed to just, you know, keeping that money in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So Ruben says, my father is turning 60 next year. He's got no pension or investments or even a house. I estimate he could work for another 5 to 10 years at his own business. How can I invest to help with him with income for retirement? And then Daniel had a very similar question. He says, I pay my mom rent. That's very good for you, Daniel. And by the way, if you guys are living with your parents, you have to contribute to the household if you're earning an income, just by the by. Don't be a freeloader. Tacky. Should I put it in a TFSA for her instead, says Daniel. She has a company pension fund, so this would be supplementing her income. I'm having a hard time convincing her that it's still a good idea to invest in a tax-free savings, although she is nearing retirement. She works for a bank's investment arm. Would they allow her to open up an account with another provider like Easy Equities? The tax-free savings account and unit trust fund options for her bank are pathetic because of the fees.
So a quick point on that. The bank will have rules. I when I worked at Standard Bank, I had to do my primary trading at Standard Bank. I had accounts with every stockbroker because they were competition and I had to keep eyes on them. And then I had to submit the statements every month from those various different accounts to the internal compliance to make sure I wasn't doing anything dodgy or illegal or anything.
So is the reason why they prevent you from doing it so that you can't do you can't get information and make money from the information?
Yeah, so you can't front run. Now with an ETF you can't, but I mean it took me 3 years to convince my compliance people that actually I couldn't front run an ETF because essentially that's front running a market.
If you could do that, we wouldn't be sitting here today, right?
No, we'd be in Durban. It's warm, I'm sure. Actually, I was there last week. It was cold and wet. They certainly like you to take their product, but they can't force you to take their product.
Yeah, because that seems illegal to me.
Yeah, so what they do is they try and incentivize you by giving you better rates and everything. But if they're not giving you better rates, then there should be no issue with opening up with Easy. But check with HR and the like.
All right, so let's discuss this issue. Basically, what is happening is we're looking at a short-term investment horizon. Mm. But then the flip side of that coin is it's a short-term investment horizon for people who are either already retired or about to retire, which has an impact on the kinds of assets that you would think about. It depends. Like what I'm thinking in both these cases is it depends on who's managing that money. Like, is it Ruben and Daniel's money? Or is it Ruben's dad's and Daniel's mom's money?
Mm. Let's touch on Daniel because I think that's perhaps an easier one. So his mother is working and earning a salary. He's paying her rent, which is then going into her general income. And he's saying, should I put it into a tax-free account for her? The answer is yes. I don't care how old she is. I don't care if she's 99. If she gets just 1 year of tax-free, that's 1 year of tax-free. Assuming she doesn't need that cash for her normal living conditions, it absolutely should. And remember that at retirement there will be policies and stuff, and she can cash those out and potentially use those for living. And actually, let's say she retires at 65. She doesn't have to cash the tax-free at 65. She only has to cash it as and when she needs the money. So at 65, perhaps, for example, because remember they pay you, a retirement annuity pays a third in cash.
If you want it.
No,
you don't have to take
it. That's right. You don't have to take it. So maybe she only needs to start dipping into that tax-free account at age 70 or 75, and not in entirety. Maybe at age 70, she needs to take out some of it because, everyone needs a holiday in the Bahamas, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is not a case of the tax-free account isn't from now until retirement. The tax-free account is from now until depletion, which could be in your estate.
So I just wanted to say something on that one third of retirement money. Somebody said to me the other day that somebody that they know is taking a third of their retirement money or some of the money from the third of their retirement money to travel the world. And the person who said this to me had a lot less money than the person who's taking a third of their money to travel the world. So you can take a third of that money, but if you've got very little saved for retirement, that is a ridiculous idea. You should not be taking a third of the income for the rest of your life. I mean, that's like saying you start your job. Do you want a third of all of the money that you're going to earn for the rest of your life up front? Like, no, that would be a dreadful idea because you're 20 and you're going to need that money when you're old.
No, I mean, you are 100% right and totally practical, but there's a flip side. Maybe it's payback time for the kids. Come back from your world travel and say, ha-ha, living in your spare room.
Well, yes.
Yes.
So just be, if you are listening to this and you're about to retire or you're going to retire in the next 5 years, you can take a third of that money, but that's literally the money that has to sustain you for the rest of your life. If you take a third to travel the world, you better have a ton of money sitting in an account.
And here's an interesting point. I am not taxed on the money I move into an annuity, or am I? I am not.
You're not. So you pay income tax on the monthly payments that you get out. So you also have control over that. So you can ask to receive the amount of money that makes you feel comfortable from an income tax perspective.
And as two individuals in old age, you can get up to around about 400,000 and not be paying much tax at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, because so short answer is if you can, I mean, just don't take that money. Just
so here's the thing. So the first third of your retirement in or the first 500,000 rand of the third of that retirement annuity that you take is tax free.
Yeah, so take that.
If your third is 500,000 rand, you do not have enough money.
Yes.
Don't take that money. It's not enough. It's not enough money to sustain you for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like 1.5 million rand is not going to last you 30 years. Mm-mm. Don't take the money.
And it's also to the point, and you said it there, 30 years. I mean, if you're 65, assume, and you're there's two of you, assume one of you is going to make it into the 90s.
Yeah.
And medical expenses and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, one of you is going to make 90.
So I'm turning 35 next year. And I saw a little thing online the other day that says it has to do with your life stages. And it was about when authors published their works, because a lot of very famous authors only publish their works later in their lives. And on the timeline, they drew 35 and they said middle age. And I was like, wow, that's really weird to think that I'm going to be middle aged next year, right? Because I've been young until now. And then I thought, but actually there was a time where people lived to 70 and that was like a long, full life. Middle age now is probably 45, not 35.
Yeah, right? I mean, from pure stats, it's 45. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. So if you've only got 1.5 million at retirement, you don't have enough money.
So the stats, and the stats are a bit old, but if you hit at age 60, your odds of making it to 90 are 50%. In 1970, at age 60, your odds of making it to 75 were 50%.
Oh.
So your potential retirement period has effectively doubled in 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So if Daniel opens a tax-free savings account, should Ruben open a tax-free savings account for his dad?
So, I mean, there are a couple of points. I mean, firstly, who's going to fund it? I mean, does Ruben's dad have the cash? Does Ruben have the cash? I mean, who's going to fund this tax-free account? Short answer is yes. But there are a couple of points. So Ruben's dad is 60 and he's saying he's got 5 to 10 years of work ahead of him. Maybe not. I mean, my grandfather worked until 92. And worked as a rep. I mean, he drove around the roads of KZN. Now, make no bones, KZN was safer with his passing. You love your granddad, but you were a menace on the road.
He survived, but who else? who lost their lives?
To his defense, you know, for him, like high speed was 40, but that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, what happened with him is he retired at 65, as one did back in, I think he retired in 1960-something, and went off to his retirement and within 2 years got his boarder's sin. So basically created himself a second job. And then worked another almost 30 years, 25 years at his second job, and had fun and did it, etc. So whilst Ruben's dad might have a current job which will retire him out perhaps, that doesn't mean it needs to necessarily be end of income.
So, well, I mean, Ruben is saying that it's his own business.
So
he could work for another 30 years.
There's a couple of points around own business. And so some own businesses are very much a case of, well, yes, it's a business, but if you're not there, it's not a business. Yeah. In other words, it's not a business that can be sold. It's not a business where you can employ someone to take over.
That's what my dad has at the moment. My dad's an electrician, so if he's not there, there's no business.
I've started a number of businesses like that, and they become of degrees of success, but you can't sell them, you can't pass them on, none of that type of thing. They earn income and then they stop earning income. And maybe part of the thing of the next 5 to 10 years is to try and transition that business into a business which his father can employ someone or sell the business.
That is such a good idea. Like, Ruben, your dad's biggest asset is his business.
Yeah. So can't he, and you know, maybe maybe the business is right now that he grows bananas and sells them to whoever. But I mean, look at what that business is and see how it can be transitioned And you've got time on your side. You've got that 5 or 10 years. Is it possible to transition that business to a place where he can now start employing people to run it, or bet to work slash in time run, or even perhaps to sell the business?
Because so if his dad makes money for the next 5 to 10 years, instead of opening a tax-free account, do you think it would be a better idea for Ruben and his dad to just take that money and plow it back into the business and try and make the business an income-earning asset? Because presumably they've already invested in the business. I mean, if you've got the business there.
It depends what it is. I mean, you know, it depends. I mean, some businesses are investment light. Some businesses are investment heavy. It depends on the business. But, you know, for an example, let's say you're an accountant and you do people's tax returns. Okay, we'll start to grow it. In other words, employ a second accountant, someone fresh out of accountancy school, and aggressively grow your base of people. So now you're both busy. So what might be a one person show can become more and more. Should Ruben's dad open a tax-free savings account? Yes. Should he fund it? Yes. Is it funded by Ruben or his dad? Both, either or. I mean, they should have. But to me, that's one part of that process. I mean, that's one of many solutions. It's not a, what I'm trying to say, this is not a one solution answer. That's one part of it. There are other angles that I would look to take as well.
Look, basically what Ruben wants here is an investment that would in 5 or 10 years be worth enough to sustain his dad in retirement. Mm. And I kind of agree. It never occurred to me to think about it this way, but you are absolutely right. Like the best thing that Ruben's dad could do is build a business that earns an income him in retirement.
Make no bones, in 10 years, Ruben's dad can put 330,000 Rand into a tax-free account. That is not enough to retire on. End of story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not enough to retire on.
Yeah.
And even if Ruben's dad could save 2 million in the next 10 years, that's not really enough to retire on either.
Look, I mean, If Ruben's dad works for another 10 years and he manages to save 2 million, then he's 70. You know, then he's got like 20 years on 2 million. I mean, it's very lit. It's not a lot of money, but it's, you know.
It's under 15,000 a month.
Yeah, but presumably in retirement, you should be able to live under 15,000 Rand a month. That's
But this now isn't growing. I mean, there's lots of T's and C's there. I mean, to my mind, 2 million is not enough to retire on unless you're living on a couple of grand. I mean, unless you're really, really living it low.
So maybe, Ruben, maybe that should also... So there's a few things you could do here. First of all, you could help your dad build this business so that it becomes an income generator for him forever.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you can help your dad reduce his cost of living,
because
there's that would help a lot.
That's an excellent point. And there's ways to around that as well, accommodations and transportations and stuff like that. So that's a really excellent angle as well, as to what can he do to cut expenses to increase saving. And in an ideal world, he's saving more than 2,750 per month, which is the tax-free limit.
Yeah.
And the excess then just goes into, find a product.
Or into the business.
Yeah.
The thing is, because you know this, this is how, if you want to aggressively grow a business, this is why we don't get dividends. Because if you want to aggressively grow a business, you take your profit, you put it back into the business, and you grow the business.
But
you get the assets, you train the people.
That is risky, because selling businesses is hard.
Yeah, but I think at this point, they shouldn't be thinking about selling a business. I think at this point, they should think about having a business that earns a steady income.
What happens is, in 70 years, Ruben's dad retires from the business. Someone takes over Ruben's dad's position, who he spent the last 5 or 10 years training up. And he, as the owner of the business, takes a stipend / dividend / payment, etc. out of the business. But there's another angle. And this happened at my mother-in-law's place. She stays at some old age home by the jail. Prison, whatever. It's an important distinction. I remind her of that every time. So what's happened is, a new couple's just moved in to the complex, and they both just hit their retirement. They had I don't know what their backstory is. But what she did was, a year and a half, or 2 years ago or so, she saw this retirement thing coming, and they're not quite sure about their money. Although, truthfully, they've got lots. But, you know, some people can worry even if you've got 1 trillion Rand in the bank. So she went out and got herself schooled in culinary cooking. And now she's doing cooking within the complex. So what she's initially starting with is frozen meals. So on Monday, she will come and knock on your door, and she's got four or five different meals in it, in Tupperwares that she can give you, and you pay for them, and you pop them in the microwave as you want to eat them. And they're either single or double portion, because, you know.
That's so clever, because you've got such a captive audience there.
And she's going to do, and she's going to, in time, expand into cakes and focus on cakes only. So cakes, not so much for the residents, but maybe for their kids and grandkids' parties and stuff like that. But what she went and did was purposely skill herself in this, which is what I find astounding. Because she's like, yeah, I mean, I can cook. I mean, you know, I'm 65, I can cook, I can make a cake, but I need to up my game. You know, when I'm making lamb stew, this now needs to be the best lamb stew you have ever tasted. So she saw this coming, and what I'm thinking here in the case of Ruben's dad is, it goes back to the point, is if middle age is now 45 or perhaps 55 if you're me, then 70 is, yeah, okay, 70, but let's not kid ourselves. 70 is still, you know, potentially healthy, potentially of sound mind, etc.
My dad turned 70 this year, and at his birthday party, he crawled under a table to get to the other side of the table, like a small boy. And I'm like, aren't you supposed to have old knees or something? You should age at some point.
So the point might be is, and we don't know what Ruben's dad's business is, but perhaps as well as looking to try and grow this business into an asset which is either saleable or income producing without Ruben's dad, is perhaps also to reskill in some area. And I don't know what that area is, but, you know, we have the interweb. So this woman did physically locate it. She's like, you know what? And part of their point was they were going to, the state they wanted to move into, the trick was, is twofold. Firstly, the managers of the estate already did frozen meals for tenants. Now, hers would be better, but more expensive, so competition. But also, the estate was smaller. It was only about 150 or 200 units. This one's 500 units. So they purposely hunted out the retirement village that they moved into.
This is such an incredible story, because you have to be... You have to be purposeful in what you do. Just because you are in your 60s or 70s doesn't mean you can just like flail about. Like, you have to be strategic. Think about it as like it is a business. And, you know, if you're lucky and you've had some experience in business before you retired, this, you know, use that. Like, use that. You've got such knowledge.
Yeah, and they used some of their money to buy her a good stove and a bigger stove, and they've bought a giant freezery, you know, I mean, et cetera. Mm. So the point is, and it's what you're saying there, is back in the day, you turned 65, you retired. Remember when retirement came in the 1880s and the German...
No, I remember it well, the 1880s.
No, man.
Best days of my life.
So what happened was Germany had a war, and the Kaiser or whatever it was, he had all these soldiers running around, and he didn't know what to do with them and stuff. So he bought in retirement, but he was very crafty. He made retirement 65. You know what the life expectancy was? 63. You were never meant to get to retirement. And if you did, he would give you a monthly stipend, and you could sit in your porch for that next 2 or 3 years before eventually you died. And you know, when you were dying, even at 75 on average, your retirement was fairly short. And by the time you hit 65, you did have old knees and couldn't climb under tables and weren't as cognitively smart, etc., etc. So retirement really was 65. But we need to view it differently. With this idea that you get to 65, you quit, and now you sit in a porch for the rest of your life, or a couch, and watch Netflix, is not how it rolls.
What's so cool about this is that you can finally, in your retirement, try to do the thing that you always wanted to do when you had to work, just, you know, and you didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, and it becomes your side hustle. I mean, to me, retirement is just going to be a quantum of side hustles.
Yeah, and so maybe if you're a bit worried about whether or not you have enough money to retire, maybe it's time to start that right now.
Yes.
Like, I'm thinking my parents have this huge property and they don't really plant anything on it. And, you know, that's something that they should have started 20 years ago or like 10 years ago, you know, developing their garden and whatever, and make that part of their
and
their
irrigating and finding supply chains and demand, etc. So, and that's the thing. So you know, Ruben's dad is 60. He's got 10 years to prepare himself. And, you know, there's many options. There's reschooling yourself perhaps in some skills for post 70, looking at the business, what you can do there. And in those 10 years, saving as much as you can into tax free and other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Man, this was a really interesting conversation. I enjoyed this.
And in truth, I'd look at it, you know, I think also the old view of retirement was, you know, end of time. I mean, retirement's going to be huge fun.
It should be huge fun. The thing is, if you are not sure about your finances in retirement, it strips away.
It's going to be totally terrifying.
It strips away a lot of the fun if you don't know. And I saw that, I haven't read it yet, but I saw Stealthy Wealth yesterday did a thing about whether or not the 4% rule applies to to the South African market. And whether or not it does is actually irrelevant. What is relevant is whether you understand how to draw down your retirement money. And that's something that you can understand. It's not a difficult thing, even though your financial advisor is probably telling you that it's difficult. It's not a hard thing to understand. So if you want to know if you have enough money to retire, you can actually just sit down and probably within 10 minutes know whether or not that's
true. You can do the math. And even if you have enough money, you still don't want to spend the next 30 years sitting on your porch.
Right, but then you can start making choices, right? So you can say, okay, I have enough money to stay at home and eat from Woolies all the time, or I have enough money to eat from Checkers and take a trip every twice a year or whatever.
Make decisions.
You can start being a bit more mindful.
And you can start doing those things you always wanted to do. And if you are financially independent at retirement, it takes the pressure off to earn. And if you always wanted to teach the piano, well, now you can just go and teach the piano without having to turn it into an income stream. And if you are short and you've always loved the piano, well, now he has an income stream. Go and learn how to teach the piano. What are the qualifications that you need, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But don't start the retirement process like you're retiring in September, so August you start. And I had a friend whose mother did that, or mother-in-law did that. You know, she retired, and like literally on day two of retirement, she's like, okay, now what? It's like, you need to start this ahead of the process and reschool. And I'm going to do woodwork.
That's nice.
And make tables.
I think I'll probably teach dance in retirement.
Yeah, but you need a Russian accent.
Yeah, the thing is, so here's the thing about teaching dance. It actually is a terrible job if you need the money, because it's like the hours are dreadful. You have to work nights because everybody dances after work. For them, it's the most fun because it's this hobby and they're learning something new. For you, it's like being on your feet 4 hours a day. Like after work at night, and then you get home at 9 o'clock. It's not amazing, but I think like for a post-retirement gig, it's awesome.
Yeah
Like great way to socialize and keep fit.
Get your shot at youngins.
Yes. Fake a Russian accent.
Easy enough.
I've got a few years to work on that. All right, so do you remember last week we heard from Get Down Adam? He wanted to buy...
Because last week was 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So he wanted to buy the property. He actually called you a destroyer of dreams.
Oh, I know who he is.
He wanted to buy a property and build three townhouses.
Can I just quickly defend myself as a destroyer of dreams, which I probably am. But I'm a purveyor of reality... Of
sense.
Of sensible questions.
You're a sense purveyor.
I didn't destroy the dreams. I asked some pointed questions. Nuance, Adam.
So I have always, my whole life, people have said to me, wow, that's a really good question. Like, I can't think of one time that somebody was like, what a great answer. But people are always like, what a really good question. You can do a lot with a good question. You can make a whole show about it, actually, if you want. All right, so Adam says he's 32. He graduated as a doctor 2 years ago. Like back in his, when he sent this email, he said he's a late bloomer. But now we've just discussed what late blooming means. He says financial people with various levels of qualifications and pizzazz came to sell us their products. Do you remember?
Yeah, who was it? Down in PE? Wilhelm? Willem?
Lallem.
Van.
Wilhelm. So close. Anyway, so as Wilhelm was saying, if you're going to be a high income earner in your mid 20s, man, you are such like low hanging fruit. It's amazing.
These folks are not discerning. If you're going to be a high income earner at any point.
Yeah.
If you
do it in your mid 20s, you've got no financial experience and you're suddenly earning so much money, man, you are just like
you're
like a sitting duck.
Yeah.
Anyway. So Adam says the bottom line was that you had to have started investing at 24, which was the age of his peers. He says, I was already 6 years behind, so I went into panic mode. So like that 24 thing, like a lot of this is very income dependent. So if you are going to be a low income earner your whole life, you have to start sooner. If you're going to earn a large amount of money and keep your lifestyle expenses low, then like starting at 24 isn't as, I mean, it would have been better, but it isn't as crucial. Anyway, so he says, 2 years into the real working world again, I've paid off my student loan of 110,000 rand. I only have about 60,000 rand left on my car loan. I've sadly given up on buying coffees and I'm back to that instant coffee. This is...
No.
You
no,
should
no.
sell the car and buy the coffee, Adam. Yeah, priorities, brother. Sheesh. He says, I limit my spending as far as possible and 22/7 is my most used app. Because I didn't understand what was happening when I started my investment journey, I signed up for a Liberty Retirement Annuity as well as a standard tax-free global equities feeder. I recently bought the Coronation Market Plus Fund simply because they had a promotional sign-up bonus of 10%, which I thought couldn't hurt. Hey, look, if it's free money, take it.
Mm-hmm.
I own a flat with my sister that our parents bought for us. We let it out and we receive about 6,000 rand per month income from that. Recently, we've been putting away 500 rand a month into an easy equities account and playing around with ETFs. I have tiny amounts in the Cloud Atlas Real Estate XSA. That's cool. That's South Africa ETF. I quite like that one. The Ashburton Global 1200. That's our favorite. The Satrix Top 40, Stanlib S&P 500, and Stanlib Global Investment Government Bond. Oh, Global Government Bonds. This is nice. It's a nice mix of, like, I wouldn't do the S&P 500 and the Ashburton Global, but, you know, this is a lacquer mix of ETFs. Interesting mix as well. He says he's got some fuck you money in Netcare, which is a disaster, Montauk Energy, and Capitec. I'm assuming him and his sister have some cash stashed in Absa, in an Absa fixed deposit to cover the maintenance and stuff. His own emergency fund is modest, but he's building a 32-day fixed deposit account for FNB. He says, am I playing with too many variables? Are there too many ETFs? I don't think there are too many ETFs. I like that mix of ETFs that you have. Like, you are doubling up on the S&P 500 and the Ashburton 1200.
Yeah, which is not the worst doubly up in the world. I mean, too many ETFs is the person who sent me the ETF portfolio and had 29.
And some ETF providers or some ETF brokers do encourage people to have that many. I mean, you're just like, you're
complicating a simple process.
I want to say you're diversifying, but sometimes you're not diversifying. Sometimes having more than one ETF actually gives you concentration risk.
And we had this conversation. I remember, who was that woman who mailed us who had tons of them? And truthfully, yes, there was duplication, but it wasn't the end of the world. You know, like, she had Japan, Europe, UK, US, and world, which is all like, you know, type of scenario. But it's not end of world, really, really.
Look, I like your ETF portfolio, Adam, I have to say. It's a lacquer one. He says, how do I know if I've saved enough? I love this question because it's so like how long is a piece of string? So, Adam, you're aiming for your monthly expenses times 300. That gets you to financial independence. Because then you can draw down 4% per year and you don't have to work anymore
That makes assumptions. To the answer to how do you know if you saved enough, the answer is you don't.
No, you do.
Well, unless you live to be 140. Does the 4% rule work if you live to be 140?
So the idea with the 4% rule is that over time it averages out. So some years the market is going to do 6% and you're only going to draw down 4%. Some years the market's going to do 1% and you're going to draw down 4%. But like, hopefully over time it averages out to around 4%.
Mm-hmm.
So like I like using the 4% rule because it gets you to financial independence and it shows you how important it is to keep your lifestyle expenses low.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you times your monthly expenses by 300, obviously the more monthly expenses you have, the bigger that number is that you're going
to
get to.
And what that means is that you die with a giant pile of money.
Yeah. So what you want to do is you want to have a target. That's how you know if you've saved enough. You shouldn't just save and be like, okay, I'm saving. Have a target to save. Understand what you want your money to do. Which is like a very difficult thing to know, but understand what you want your money to do and then you'll know whether you have enough of it or not. Mm-hmm. He says, what's the difference between building a portfolio and just summer buying and hoping you're right? It's a very good question. I think the answer is intentionality.
Okay, which is better than mine, which is not much.
That's a terrible answer.
No, I will tell you that I build a portfolio and I do it with deep thought and insight and purpose and everything else. But in truth, I'm buying and hoping it goes up, aren't I?
No, because like building a portfolio is, it's to do with asset allocation.
Mm-hmm.
So do you understand what different assets do and how they work and what they, like the kind of risk they contribute?
Mm-hmm.
It's to do with concentration risk and, mm-hmm. you know, are you investing too much in one thing versus another thing?
Mm-hmm.
You have to be intentional about where you put your money.
Yeah, I hear you. But the only part really, really we can, taking it as a given that our ability to see into the future is zero, the only thing really we can control is concentration risk. And just don't put all your apples into one basket.
So it's diversification. It's
diversification.
And that is...
And ETFs are click-click diversification. He's got two individual stocks as long as they're not, you know, half of his portfolio.
He's got three. Yes.
Mm, what's the third one?
Capitec.
No, I know that one.
Montuk?
No, that one.
And the one.
Oh.
Netcare.
Ah, didn't hear that one. I don't...
Maybe you didn't want to hear that
no,
one.
No, I think health companies are a piece of anything to do with health. You have insanely large legislative risk coming your way in the next 100 years.
But I mean, you can also see why somebody who's qualified as a doctor would choose a healthcare company
to
invest, because you invest in what you understand.
No, he's looked under the skirt. He should... Okay.
Maybe he's probably literally looked under the skirt.
And Capitec, because I own it, in Montauk, because I remember writing in Finweek that this was a rubbish stock approximately 4 minutes before it went up approximately 10 gabillion, dizillion, cotillion percent.
They're the renewable energy. I remember you and I spoke about them.
They take the gas off the rubbish piles in the US and turn it into
That's
energy.
Very clever.
Yeah, it's very... No, I don't want to talk about it. So it's, I think the thing you can control is, get to the 300 point and 300 times your monthly income and watch concentration risk.
Yeah, and concentration risk, not in terms just of sectors, but also in terms of asset allocation. So what I really like about your portfolio, Adam, is that you've got, you've got real estate, you've got nice high risk real estate, which I really like, because you've got that Cloud Atlas thing, which is African real estate, mm-hmm. which is nice because you're pretty young still and you can afford to take on that risk. And then he's got the global government bonds, which is a nice little diversification in mm-hmm. addition to some cash. Your portfolio looks lacquer, Adam. I think you're good. Like, don't buy those properties and you'll be you'll be lacquer. If you struggle to keep track of your net worth, you might have too many variables. If you're using 22/7, that's a really nice way to just keep track of what's going on. Like, if you're getting to a point where you're like, oh, I don't really know how much money I have and where it is and whatever, then that's too many variables. But if you feel on top of it, then it's good. What I do want to say is that people who are high income earners, like doctors, tend to underestimate the impact that fees could have over time.
Mm-hmm.
So, Adam, sit down and go and make sure you know exactly what you are paying for everything in your portfolio. And if something is too expensive, I'm not going to say what I think is too expensive, but if something if something looks too expensive for you, because you're still young, you can probably take a penalty on moving that expensive thing that I'm not going to mention to a cheaper version of that expensive thing.
And you know what? Take the hit. Just take the hit. And if it's new, like 2 years old, it might actually have zero value if you try and move it. Then just make it paid up and move on.
So we actually have somewhere on our website in the Fat Wallet show notes
a calculator.
Calculator that tells you exactly when you'll break even if you move something and pay penalty.
Pretty much if you're under 45, every time it works to move.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing well, Adam. Give yourself a little credit. He says, please fix me, or at the very least, tell me I can drink decent coffee again.
Yeah,
drink decent coffee.
Adam, drink coffee.
Yeah, just do that. Take all those fees that you're paying and then go buy good coffee. Life is too short. Frank shared a great graph that he found of a married couple's shared finances. I'll include a link in the show notes. It's to a Reddit, Reddit thread. But... He points out there's a line item in the graph is called black magic, which is how they account for the money that just fell through the cracks. Because they're like, okay, we got this money. We spent this money. There's this like amount of money. It's like $700 or something for the year. And they just call it black magic. because they can't actually account for where that money goes, which is really interesting. No,
but every year you get there and they don't add up.
Yeah, and it's like, where is this money? So what I'm doing, ever since I read Sam's book, because Sam Beck Basinger, who wrote Manage Your Money Like Grown Up.
Mm-hmm.
Adult?
Grown Up.
Grown Up?
Grown Up.
Anyway, so she was involved in developing 22/7. And ever since I read her book, I've been using 22/7, which just turns out to be an awesome little app. Because what it lets you do is, if you draw cash, you can actually go onto 22/7 and split that amount. So I can do that. So when I pay my rent, for example, I pay my rent and I pay my rates and taxes into the same account. Then I can go onto 22/7 and split the transaction and say, this was rent and this was rates and taxes. But I also do that for cash withdrawals, because I find that that's where the most money falls through the cracks for me. That's like my black magic it's always cash that I drew that I can't
account
for.
So my cash draws in 22/7 are marked secret.
Why?
Just to f*** with anyone who's watching my account.
Because
I don't know where that money goes. It's cash. And you know me, I walk around with lots of it.
Yes. Like a ridiculous amount of cash.
Yeah.
You're like the perfect candidate for pickpocket. Like, I'm hoping like the pickpockets who listen to this show don't pickpocket you. So that's a really cool tip. If you also find that you have like black magic money, the 22/7 app is really, really awesome to keep track of where that sort of money goes. George, whom we haven't heard from in a long time.
Oh, just quick point on 22/7. Don't worry about security. Do worry if they're trying to sell you something. The answer is no.
Yeah, so they do this thing where they're like, I think they call it goals or whatever. And they basically try and get you to invest in an old mutual unit trust or something. Just steer very, very clear of that. Anyway, you know, and this is also one of those things we were talking the other day to Outvest about services that we get online. 22/7 is an incredible tool, and it's free. It's like a free.
So they tried to charge for it. Remember, they launched it, and then it was free, and then they tried to charge, and customer base just evaporated. And in fact, I spent a whole lot of time creating a little script to do it myself, and then Old Mutual bought them, and they came back as free.
Yeah, so what Old Mutual are wanting to do is they want you to invest in the unit trusts to make it worthwhile. Yeah. But
don't.
But I mean, it's just such an incredible product that is available for free online that if they charged for it, you wouldn't pay it, because technically you could do all of that stuff yourself. It's just somebody wrote like a beautiful program to do it for you. But it's just it's amazing to think that it's a free service.
We get astounding stuff as human beings these days at no cost.
But we've also become such brats, because now we don't want to pay for anything, right?
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, like, as a free online service, you and I understand this very well. But, Anyway, so George was asking if he can withdraw profits from his tax-free account without affecting his lifetime limit.
Sure.
Yeah.
But why?
Well, maybe you need the money.
Okay, maybe you need the money. So how it works is you've got a 500,000 lifetime limit, right? So let's say you put 30,000 in. Your lifetime limit is now 470,000 remaining. You grow your 30,000 to whatever and you withdraw some money, your limit is still 470. So even if you took out the 30 and your profit, you can only put 470 back in. That makes sense. So you can take the money out. The point is, I mean, and if you need the money for some real reason, not coffee, well, okay, yeah, for some real reason, then sure. But the point is you want to compound that profit and earn the tax free on the compound, and get the real power. And I mean, you know, over a 25-year period of a decent growth, etc. By the time you get to the end, the tax-free component is massively significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can do it.
But you can.
So John Luke is a freelancer. He works in the TV industry, and he's in his 40s. And he has no debt except for a house that he's got a home loan. Mm-hmm. And he'd like to renovate the house before he sells it. So he did have a house, and then he renovated it. He sold it. He made a nice profit, did it again. So he lives there, but then he sells it for a profit. So the TV industry, apparently, he lives in Cape Town, has been going through a bit of a dry spell. So he'd been saving...
hold on. When I lived in Cape Town in the early 90s and I worked in the TV industry, he was going through a dry spell, and I suspect it's been a dry spell for 25 years. Just saying, John Luke.
But like, he did make some money before, and now he's really struggling. So he's been saving money to do renovations in the house, but work has been drying up, so he's had to use basically all of his cash savings as an emergency fund. Mm-hmm. So he's aiming for an emergency fund of 8% of his overall net worth. He's currently sitting on just over 2.5%. He says, in the next few years, I can envision a bumpy ride in my chosen profession. I may need to draw down my emergency fund again, and it won't last as long as I need it to. Should I do what I've done in the past and go into my overdraft and credit cards, or should I draw money from my share portfolio? Keep in mind, this would be for a short-term period of 3 to 9 months. So I'm assuming that's the amount of time that it between jobs for him. My instinct would be to leave my shares alone and just give them a chance to grow. I'm also on a strict plan to downscale my spending and to save more. My goal is to be saving 25% of my earnings by the end of next year, but getting there is a bit of a delicate process, especially considering the current conditions of the film industry. I'm also loath to sell my current house until I've had a chance to do the renovations. There's some money to be made for sure. So this is something that Jennifer taught us, because she doesn't earn an income every month. And then she worked out that you should, instead of saving a percentage of your salary, you should save a percentage of whatever it is that you are earning. So whatever it is of the invoice
of
that you submit.
So, I mean, to the question of should he go into debt or sell the shares, he's right, go into debt. You know, this is all the provisos that you will manage the debt and be responsible and all of that, but don't sell the shares, take the debt.
So because he's depleted his emergency fund. His options now are either go into debt or sell the shares. Yeah. I agree with you.
And a quick point on the renovating, notwithstanding he's done it before, is be careful that you don't overcapitalize a house for an area which it's in. But if you're in an area, there's a band of what properties are worth, say 1 to 2 million. If you're already at the 2 million, don't do that. But if you're at the one, you know, don't make your house, you might price the house out of the area.
Right, that's a really good tip. Yeah, because if your house is worth 1 million and you're in a 2 million rand area, if you spend 250,000 rand and you can sell your house for 1.5 million, then that's lacquer. If you're already at 2 million, you know, spending another 250,000 rand is not gonna, you're not gonna get it. Mm. Yes, that's so. Somebody actually wrote us asking for tips on selling a house because they're going through a process, which we'll get to in a future episode. But
oh, no, that's easy. Arsonists.
G-Boy, which is a real name of a person who has written us. No, it's not. It's a pseudonym. Has taken his expensive RA by the horns. He wants to know how to allocate money between an RA and a TFSA. He also says a house is a bottomless money pit. I tend to agree.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I've moved my RA from Sunlum to Easy Equities, mm-hmm. and I've opened a tax-free savings account also with Easy Equities. Should I max out my tax-free savings account and then contribute to my RA, or equally contribute to both my RA and tax-free savings account? You and Simon made me feel so about the RA trap. At least I made the move to Easy Equities so that I can control it and not pay over 4% TER every year. So here's what I do. I contribute to my RA first because you get that a rebate from for contributing to an RA or a pension product. And then I use the money that I get back from the government for contributing to an RA, and I put that into my tax-free savings account. Mm. And that's what I would recommend you do, because then you save tax on two fronts. Mm. So use your tax savings to get more tax savings.
Nothing to add.
And then feel really good about yourself. So Levuyo wants to know if we think rewards programs are worthwhile. He says, do you think certain reward points is to your benefit financially? I have an Investec account, which gives decent reward points. Obviously not as great as eBucks that everybody is telling me about. I have Discount Clicks, Woolies, and an entertainer account. And I only buy clothing, get this, through a family member that works at a clothing store at a massive discount. That's cool.
Whoa.
That's very cool. If you guys work at a clothing store and you can give me a massive discount of clothing, you have to write me right now. He says, do you think that using, I didn't know this was a thing, obviously. Do you think that using different discount and reward offerings can materially affect keeping your lifestyle costs low so that you free up funds to invest? Or am I just a cheapskate that gets slightly marginal benefits from the above? I definitely see massive benefits in reward points.
But you know what? If you, even if you're only getting marginal benefits, the trick is do you get the benefit? So,
What does it cost you to get the benefits?
Exactly. So, for example, you know, I belong to very few because I've been selective, you know, and I won't carry a Clicks or Dis-Chem card because I don't shop there. There's like,
you're a fool not carrying a Dis-Chem card because the Dis-Chem reward points actually are among the better reward points.
But you know how
points.
Much money I've spent at Dis-Chem in my life?
How much?
Zero.
Oh, well, I love Dis-Chem. I love Dis-Chem. I would spend all of my money at Dis-Chem if I could. I love that store so much. And what's really great... yes, sis. Like that look you're giving me
that,
right now.
That might be reportable. I just don't know who I would report it to. Like, internet, like, this lady needs help.
No, what's really great is that Dis-Chem's reward points, they actually give you... It's actually cash. So you can just go to Dis-Chem and buy something with your reward points. It's not like you have to convert it into something and then convert it into something else. But what's really cool is if you fill up your car or your car at Total, and you give your Dis-Chem card.
Is Total still a thing?
So this is so much of a benefit that I actually now only fill up my car at Total. I actually drive out of my way to go to a Total to fill up my car because of the Dis-Chem points that you get.
How much does your car cost to run per kilometer?
I don't know, but like it costs me just over 500 rand now to fill up. And I get about 500 Ks per tank. So.
So buck a kilometer. Yeah, but then depreciation, insurance. Yeah. I mean, okay. So the thing with reward points is as long as they're not making you do things that you would not normally do. For example, if they're like, well, if you buy this super duper peach colored banana, you will earn points. And like you have no need or desire or want for a super duper peach colored banana.
Which a lot of them do. It's a lot often of them a do. Trap.
But if it is just a case of, and you run the numbers. So I have, for example, an SAA one, which you don't pay for, but I am one of the few people. I mean, my wife and I took 3 local flights over the last sort of end of last year, and all of them cost us 204 rand a flight because I used my miles, and that actually works. And my Standard Bank one costs me money every month, but I got a PlayStation 4 VR out of it, and what I paid was like maybe 400 rand, and what I got was like 10 grand. So if the numbers work out, then yeah.
So I was very skeptical of the Vitality program, and it's actually turned out it works in my favor 100%. Like I get cash money into my account every month because of my healthy food choices, and I get discounts at the gym and all of that. Like forget about the free smoothies because like I can afford a smoothie, but like the actual financial benefit. Because you do pay money to belong to Vitality to begin with, but the financial benefit has been
but then also I remember I had this conversation with you. For example, you get cash back on vegetables that you buy, but the price of the vegetable less the cash back, is that cheaper than going to Impala where they have the cheapest veg in the world? I mean, it's so you know.
No, but you don't. I don't just buy.
Interesting. So that's run the numbers. Work out that yes, they give me cash back if I buy Woolies overpriced vegetables. But even that into account, it's cheaper to buy it from the greengrocer. In other words, don't buy your veg there. You know.
Yeah, but you still get cash back on stuff that you can't get at Impala.
Sure.
And I still do. So there's this really awesome shop on Bayers Nordea in Joburg, if you don't know what an Impala is. It's called Impala and they do fruits and veggies. It's like
I've only just discovered it, but bananas.
An old-fashioned greengrocer. But so I worked out once. I went there, I did my shopping. Then I went onto the Woolworths website and I did item by item if I had bought it at Woolworths, and the saving was like 155 rand or whatever just from going to a different store. But you still they do still sell stuff at Woolworths that qualify for the Vitality points back.
Yeah, sure.
And I get that money back every month.
So I suppose to Lavoie's question is that be smart about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And use the Dis-Chem thing because like – the thing is, what makes Dis-Chem such a cool store is because you get your drugs there, but you then also get, like, I get a whole bunch of stuff for dance from Dis-Chem, you know, like makeup and that sort of thing.
You know what freaked me about Dis-Chem is, like, when I was there and there was someone, like you're buying drugs and they've got a trolley. I mean, how much drugs can a human being do?
You know, I can spend hours in Dis-Chem. Sometimes I just go in there for fun. I don't even buy anything. I just walk around. Okay. I love it.
Internet,
so
send
much.
Help. That is a cry for help if ever I heard one.
Johannes wants to know if I'll do a spreadsheet on all the costs involved in purchasing a home. I'd be happy to do this as the process goes along. Like, so far, I've spent 453 Rand on sectional title and deed reports. And once the home loan gets approved, I'll spend 2,875 Rand on an inspection. So that brings me to 3,300 Rand before anything has actually happened.
Then you'll pay transfer costs and bond registration fees and lawyer fees. You won't pay transfer costs because you're under 900K.
Yes. No, I'm not. I bought a 4 million rand house because I have lots of money.
Then you're paying transfer costs.
Someone has
to pay tax.
I'm not paying a transfer. I bought under 900,000. So far, that's 3.3. Then the cost of move, I'll include in that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I should include stuff like new curtains?
Yeah, so then, I mean, there's incidentals, and it is. It's new curtains. For example, your internet. I mean, I don't know what that deal is, but, you know, that sort of thing. There are other incidentals. There's a deposit you're going to have to make at city council to get lights and water and sewerage and that sort of stuff.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
And all of that, and then try and get it back. I just, like, basically, you know what, Joe, you, just you give can up keep your it. Yeah, fuck it. I mean, they fix my streets. It's a fair trade.
So what's really interesting for me about the cost of moving is, so I like to have my curtains a bit higher than standard curtains. So I always buy the longer curtain, which means every time I move, I have to move my curtain rails up a few centimeters higher than they were. And
is this like a Dis-Chem thing that you like your curtains longer?
Yes.
Okay. And then it makes
it
sense.
Just makes your house look a little less squat.
Lifts it. Yeah. So you know another secret to make your house less squat? Look at your skirt, your cornices and the ceiling are painted the same color as the ceiling. If you paint them the same color as the wall, it lifts your ceiling.
Oh.
Mm.
Anyway, so in my new place, my ceilings are very low and I can't have my curtains as high as I want them because they would be right up against the ceiling, which means that I would have now to buy new curtains that are standard length. And that's like such a stupid thing because I just moved into this place and I just bought new curtains for this place.
I don't get what the problem is having them touch the ceiling, but can't you just chop their legs a bit?
Yeah, I'm sure I can, but like...
You have a sewing machine?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
And even if I did, I don't know how to drive that.
No, me neither. Me neither. But there's someone living in a retirement village who does.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Anyway, so it's like one of those small things that you don't really think about, but now I'm going to have to get new curtains or pay somebody to chop the legs off my curtains and whatever. So, yeah, fees.
Mm. Fees.
Anyway, all right. We've got two more questions for this week, but we've hit an hour, so let's park it. You guys have noticed we're running a little bit behind.
Ciao.
We'll
this week, because it's a live recording at the JSC, we'll be even further behind.
Oh, dear. We'll get to you eventually, I promise.
Promise.
That's it from the Just One Lap team this week. You can catch us, as Simon mentioned, at the JSE on Thursday night. It's a free event. Please come and join us.
5:30.
Remember that this is a show about questions. If you're at the JSE, you can actually come and ask us in person and we'll just answer you right there. But if you would like your question answered on the podcast, send your question to ask@justonelap.com. My name is Christy Van Heerden. Thank you so much to Simon Brown. We will catch you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.